Bennett. It's Morning in America. Delighted to have Michael Rubin, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, join us again. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Bill.
I've got a ton to talk about, and I'll start with a question I didn't warn you about, but we're doing these top 10 stories of the year. What's the most important thing to have happened in Iraq, Afghanistan, or Pakistan this year, would you say?
Most important thing in Afghanistan would be the, in both countries, actually, would probably be the flawed elections. And because they really are setting the stage for the next several years and how we, what crises are going to crop up.
Okay. Let's go to Iraq first. You just got back. Thank you for the list of the people whom you met. Quite remarkable. What determines who you'll meet with, who's available? But you start, was this kind of your wish list? Governors of Najaf, former governor of Soleimani?
Well, when it came to Najaf, it far exceeded my wish list.
Okay.
Najaf is the Shia holy center. It's basically the Shia religious center, the pilgrimage site. And the thing with dealing with Iraq is you can't make appointments 2 weeks in advance like you do in the United States. You just have to go and take your chances because no one's going to really schedule an appointment more than 24 hours in advance.
But you saw a lot of people.
I saw a lot of people. I mean, people around. So given it's not only Americans that can't make a meeting more than 24 hours in advance,
okay.
It's everyone. So you go there, you take your chance. And, I was extremely fortunate to meet with three of the four grand ayatollahs,
yes.
The highest spiritual guys, not only in Iraq, but arguably in Shia Islam. We had long discussions about Iraqi politics, Shiism and so forth, but what's really important as an analyst for me is to get a sense of their personalities, because the higher you go with these people, the more they talk in generalities and, if you will, almost riddles. And of course, I'm not going to convert to Shiism or anything like that, but you get a sense by talking to them about, by looking at the questions they ask, by looking at who's addicted to what conspiracy theories, who seems more centered and realistic about policy, you really get a sense of how these guys who are so important in the background are going to affect things. And also one of the big questions on everyone's mind in Iraq is the fourth Grand Ayatollah, Grand Ayatollah Sistani.
Right.
People suggest that he may not be in the best health, and so there's a lot of talk about who will succeed him. So the three guys who I met with are pretty much the three candidates to succeed Sistani. So that it was.
Who's the guy who was we were worried about, the troublemaker back when, little guy running around?
Oh, the little guy running around is still a little guy running
What's
around.
What's his name?
His name is Muqtada al-Sadr.
Yeah, right.
And he's
sorry.
Actually...
a little guy running around, sorry.
He's in Qom right
okay.
now.
All right.
Now his,
does that mean he's sort of out of the picture?
He's out of the picture for now, but he could always come back in the picture. The thing with Iran is, Iran is to Iraq what Pakistan is to Afghanistan. It becomes.
Say that again.
Iran is to Iraq
right.
what Pakistan is to Afghanistan. It really becomes a safe haven for a lot of bad guys, and the governments in Iran and Pakistan take their time and insert these bad guys back into the country whenever they think it's in their interest.
All right. Well, what's the deal in Iraq? I mean, our guys are gone, and they're gone, right?
Our guys are going to be gone at the end of this coming year.
End of this coming year, but many have left, right?
Many have left, and what?
Things
what
okay?
Forget is,
are things okay? Relatively stable?
Things are okay, but it's spotty.
Okay.
Let me put it this way: after 9 months. Iraq finally has a government, sort of, because they're going to have 41 ministers, but they only announced 25 ministers, and the rest are still getting bargained over. The problem here is what looks good on a memo in Washington doesn't necessarily translate well into Iraq. For example, what we've tried to do is say to the Iraqis after these elections that every major political bloc should be in the government. And there's good reasons for doing this, mostly because we are afraid that if anyone is left out of the government, that they might resort to violence.
Right.
Now, imagine in the White House, if you had Karl Rove and Rahm Emanuel sharing an office because someone thought, hey, we should put the two biggest political factions together. It doesn't necessarily make for an efficient government.
Yeah, sure. And that's what you've got.
That's what we got in Iraq. On paper, it looks great that all these major factions are involved. In reality, there's a lot of pessimism that this government's going to be able to produce anything.
Will it hold together? Are we going to be reading in a year or 2 years Iraq's coming apart again?
We may.
We may.
That's a real problem. There's a question about whether it will hold together. There's a question about what happens when some of the people who are involved, frankly, die. Jalal Talabani, the Kurdish president, is not in good health, but he's president again. What happens if he has a heart attack? It may not happen tomorrow. It may not happen the next month. But we're talking about a 75-year-old guy who is going to be president for the next 4 years.
All right.
So there's a problem there. That's the pessimistic aspect of this.
All right.
The other pessimistic aspect is when you look at Baghdad, and I saw Baghdad both during the day, and I actually drove through the streets of Baghdad in an Iraqi army Humvee after midnight one night. Baghdad's not in good shape. One of the metrics, and I think I've told you this before, that I always look for are the cranes. I mean, do you see new construction? Do you see signs of progress? Baghdad, you don't. Now, in the north, in Iraqi Kurdistan, you do, and also in the south. The south is booming. And so that's where my optimism is. You really do see a recovery, but instead of a recovery from the center spreading outward, you actually have a recovery starting on the periphery. Hopefully, it will extend inward.
All right. You can stay another segment, can't you? I want to talk to you about Afghanistan and Pakistan a little bit as well. You noted on your note to me, Bill may be interested in the fact that I met with the Catholic Cardinal of Baghdad. Didn't know there was such a person.
Well, this is the thing. I actually met not only with Cardinal Dilley in Baghdad, the Catholic Cardinal of Iraq, but also with the head of the Syrian Orthodox Church, the Syrian Catholic Church, the Armenian Church, and so forth.
They put those guys in a room together, like Rove and Emanuel, or is that pushing it?
You could actually put these guys in a room together because they all see themselves as having a greater enemy at this point.
Great.
I also visited
good. That's good.
I visited the church that al-Qaeda attacked recently, killing 40 or 50 parishioners during services.
That was Christian church, right?
That Christian church. It was actually a Syrian, a Syrian Catholic church.
Okay.
I mean, it's scary. You see the bloodstains on the walls. You see the bloodstains on the ceiling, which is about 40 feet high. You see the indent where the suicide bombers attacked. I could send you some photos afterwards that I took. But what you have a massive flight of Christians out, and this is dominating all conversations I had, both with Christian community leaders as well as, frankly, Muslims, because the Christians, it's not just an issue of religious freedom, although that's front and center. It's also an issue of Iraq's legacy. These Christians have been there since immediately after the birth of Christ.
All right.
And you've seen just in the months since that attack, you've seen over 1,000 flee. Now, when you have 1,000 families flee, when you figure that maybe there's only about 5,000 or 6,000 families left, that's a bad sign.
5,000 or 6,000 Christian families, you mean?
Yes.
Okay. Let's talk about Afghanistan. You can link it to your earlier point. We're talking to Michael Rubin, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, who's just back. You said, that Iraq is to Iran as Afghanistan is to Pakistan. Afghanistan, a lot of movement and talk over there lately. The president seems to have extended the deadline from 2011 to 2014, but from what you sent me, this didn't seem to go down very well. It didn't seem like much of a bright sign to people. People said, you can't just say 2014. Our forces may not be ready yet.
Well, I have to admit, I don't have much hair left, but I was pulling it out when I heard Obama's comments about 2014, because I think one of the biggest mistakes he's made on Afghanistan is voicing the July 2011 deadline.
So it's continue to keep giving dates is the mistake?
Exactly, because...
Okay. Even if it's 3 years, 4 years into the future.
Exactly, because I think I said this before. Afghans have never lost a war.
No,
they just switched to the winning side.
And the three or four years does not mean a whole heck of a lot to them. Right?
No, it doesn't mean a whole heck of a lot to them. And what they will think is that if the Americans are going to be gone in 2014, then we've got to make our alliances now with Pakistan, with Iran, or other bad guys. And this is what a lot of the Afghans were saying. They were actually responding not only to President Obama, but to Biden's statement on 2014.
Yes,
Biden said, I think on Meet the Press on December 19th, that, quote, we're going to be totally out of Afghanistan come hell or high water in 2014. And the funny thing was, look, Biden shoots his mouth off to the press all the time, but this is in direct contradiction to what we had said at the NATO summit in November in Lisbon. NATO had agreed that the transfer of responsibility would be completed by 2014, but not the withdrawal of international forces, and that whatever withdrawal did occur would occur on the condition that the Afghan security forces were trained, equipped, and up for the job. So a lot of Afghans, both those who are favorable to Karzai and those that are favorable to us, basically said, this is a huge mistake.
Yeah. All right. It's interesting because here domestically, a lot of people, including myself, kind of focused on the fact that, well, it's not 11 anymore, it's 14. He's extended his commitment. But
right. Well, this is the biggest difference between President Obama and President Bush. When you look at the surge in Iraq, President Bush never actually announced a date for the end of the surge.
Yeah.
So, and two things. He never announced a date, so psychologically it was open-ended for the enemies we were facing. And he talked about victory. He talked about how we were going to be there until victory. Now, what Vice President Biden has done is not only take President Obama's 2014 date, but then said, we're going to be out of there come
hell or high water.
That's quite different than victory.
Yeah, because it sure as heck may be hell if we say that, particularly if we promise that. My concern, even with the 2014, which a lot of us thought was a good idea, not to be specific about the date, but at least it suggested a longer-term commitment. But a lot of people feel the Democrat base will not support the president of Afghanistan and American public. I have a caller on now, Greg. I'm just going to put the words in my mouth. You know, he's opposed to it. Greg's probably a good conservative. A lot of people oppose. Get out now. This is the longest war, et cetera, et cetera. Michael?
Yeah, no, I certainly understand that. The question is, let me put it this way. The question is, what would happen if we withdrew? Would the Taliban take over? Would it become a vacuum? Some people would say, look, all we got to do is strike a deal with the Taliban whereby they would agree not to sponsor terror training camps and not to host al-Qaeda. That's easier said than done. We had over 30 meetings with them before 9/11 in which they promised the same thing but didn't deliver. Ultimately, though...
Before 9/11.
Before 9/11, from 1995 to basically until George Bush entered the White House, we had a sustained dialogue with the Taliban, up to and including people like Bill Richardson, the former governor of New Mexico, who recently has been off in North Korea.
Okay. So there's no reason to think they'd keep those agreements.
There's no reason to think they'd keep those agreements, and that's the fundamental problem.
But I guess
would al-Qaeda come back?
Right. I mean, that's a rational response. The question is, will it hold politically in the U.S.? I don't know. Now, throw Petraeus into this, because I always say in these arguments, and I'm for our staying till we win, is that you don't appoint Petraeus if if you're planning to get out. He doesn't want to be 1-1. He wants to be 2-0.
No, you're absolutely right. Where I may differ a little with Petraeus, though, is, Petraeus, of course, has done wonders when it comes to COIN, counterinsurgency, really clearing, holding, and building, and I'm all for that. The problem I have with what we're doing in Afghanistan and, frankly, what we did in Iraq has to do with our development strategy. We're throwing billions of dollars into these countries, basically so the State Department or USAID can show that they're capable of doing something. And the fact of the matter is, what it's done is it sparked massive corruption. When you actually drive around these countries, you don't really see much bang for the buck.
Now, you don't see the cranes, as you said, right?
Exactly. Yeah. In Afghanistan, we've done a great deal when it comes to the Ring Road. which is important to hold Afghanistan together. Right. But all the school buildings, all the development projects, look, I can understand why on paper they're important, but if you figure that 70% of that money is going to fuel corruption, and that corruption then fuels other bad things which ultimately hurt our troops, I'm not sure whether we should be flooding these countries with money.
All right, and one of the other things, I'll end with this, and it's just we're going to have you back for an hour in the new year if you'll come back, okay?
Okay, sure.
Is this, I was watching CBS and saw that Laura Logan, who has, you know, spent time there in Iraq and now Afghanistan, but she was talking about Pakistan. She said, you know, it's not Iran, it's not Iraq, it's not Afghanistan. Our major problem is Pakistan. And she said, you know, we may even know where bin Laden is. She said, now we know where these terrorists are inside Pakistan. We have information right down to their phone numbers. So the Afghans have this information, too. The U.S. has it, the Pakistanis have it, but no one's acting on it. Vast majority of terrorist leaders that threaten the U.S. today are located inside Pakistan, and the U.S. is failing to deal with that. Is that true? Could that be true?
That strikes me as true. Wow. Pakistan is really a malignant force. It's an ally in name only. The problem with Afghanistan is that it's a landlocked country. But one other point to make with regard to Pakistan, some people in both the United States and especially in Great Britain will say, look, we can deal with the Taliban. After all, we can use the same model that the British used in dealing with the IRA, the Irish Republican Army. The biggest difference, however, between the Taliban and what was going on with the Irish Republican Army is the Irish Republican Army did not have state support. The Taliban does have state support, and that state support is Pakistan.
We have a minute left. What do we do about Pakistan? What do we do?
Ultimately, look, we've got to play hardball.
Right.
We've got to stop relying on diplomatic smoke and mirrors. Frankly, I think it's come to a time when we have to choose sides. We should be having much greater outreach to India. Pakistan does have nuclear weapons, and that's ultimately the concern we have. We're concerned about state failure, state collapse in Pakistan, but I'm not sure that means that we have to continue to be putting Pakistan, bailing it out to the tune of billions of dollars.
The president had a trip to Pakistan. Was that a step in the right direction? I mean, to India. Was that a step in the right direction?
I do think that's a step in the right direction. Okay. And also remember that President Bush had done more than any other president since Harry S. Truman to try to set our relations with India right.
Well, to be continued. We covered a lot. We need to do it in more depth, and we'll do it early in the new year. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Michael.